Morning, committee come to order. Thank you. Obviously, like the committee before us and everything that follows us, it's a full agenda, so we will move as expeditiously as possible today. There is one change to the proposed agenda that's before you today. Take the public hearing action item for the budget and CIP. That would become an information item. We've had a request from Virginia, which I understand is at least conceptually reported by the, supported by the other jurisdictions, to have a little more time to analyze some of the significant fare and service changes that are part of the general manager's proposal. So in the interest of accommodating that, the actual vote to initiate the public hearing process will be scheduled for our January meeting. We will still have a presentation. We will surface some of the proposed amendments to that public hearing docket, but there will not be actual, full debate to its conclusion and vote on the merits on those. So with that, I move the agenda as so modified. Do I have a second from a committee member?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? No. The agenda is approved. We also have the minutes from our previous meeting, November 7th. Could I get a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Minutes are approved. Okay. So just a brief reminder, when this committee is considering the budget, there is full participation by all members of the board. However, the items we have to vote on today are voting is limited to the committee members present here today. So, I'll briefly recap what we'll be talking about today. First item will be authorizing public hearing on parking at Grosvenor Strathmore. We will hear about a joint development agreement proposal related to West Hyattsville. We will discuss a low-income fare pilot program in the District of Columbia. As mentioned a moment ago, we will discuss the initiation of the public hearing process for the 2021 budget and 21 through 26 CIP. And then finally, we will have a working session on the capital budget. And as a reminder to the committee and the rest of the board, there will be a second working session in January covering the operating budget. So today, if we could confine our questions to the capital side of the budget and preserve that commentary for the on the other parts to the January discussion. So with that, I turn over to Ms. Albert for the first item.
Thank you so much and good morning. The first agenda item is a request to the board to authorize a compact public hearing, which authorization would allow us to defer the replacement of 200 parking spaces at Grosvenor Strathmore until such spaces are needed. Just some background, and the reason that we're bringing this to you is because the Grosvenor Strathmore Metro Station is the site of an approved joint development. The board authorized a joint development solicitation in 2013. And in early 2017, the board authorized and we executed, staff executed, a joint development agreement with Five Squares Development. The developer has very aggressively been working with the county's planning staff, planning board, and has gotten city council or county council approval for a variety of entitlements that are required. The vision for the site is quite compelling. Originally, when we embarked on this joint development process, we assumed that what was authorized was approximately 500 to 600 residential units. Through the work that the developer and the county have done together, They have approved 1.9 million square feet of mixed-use development for residential, retail, and other commercial uses. And then there are also some bonus densities permitted. This is a total of six buildings. It includes a 1.2-acre civic park. And the vision that the developer and the county have developed for the Metro Station is for a residential community that appeals and caters to a community that's interested in arts and park space and green space. And if you understand the context of this station, there's a tremendous park asset that is an extension of Rock Creek Park and the Strathmore Music Center estate. So in total, if the full 1.9 million were to be built out, we could anticipate more than 4,000 new daily riders at this station. And of course, this is why we do this business. As part of the joint development agreement was a one-for-one replacement parking agreement. So there's a surface parking lot that currently contains 400 parking spaces, which is the prime area for the joint development. And so what we agreed to with the developer is that they would expand our existing garage by those 400 spaces. And the expansion would happen in two directions, one to the south that contains 200 parking spaces and one to the west that contains the remaining 200 spaces. The southern expansion has already begun construction and will be completed in summer of 2020. Given construction pricing, the western expansion is quite significant, between $10 to $15 million, in part because we have to displace a stormwater management pond and also an existing arts walk. So what we are proposing, particularly because the Grosvenor Turnback has been eliminated and people can get to the White Flint Metro Station, which has significant vacancy and is not far up the road, we are proposing to delay the replacement of the west, or not moving forward now, but holding in reserve for the future to be able to do the western expansion. And there are a couple points. One is, as I mentioned, it's expensive to move forward now. Second is that we don't have a construction start date for joint development on the surface lot yet. So for a while, we will actually have the 200 space expansion plus the surface parking lot still available. So there will not be an immediate impact or removal of total spaces for some time. And then I'll discuss in the next slide some survey work that we've done with our parking customers to see if diverting people to White Flint would be a real possibility. So in October of this year, we issued a customer survey to SmartTrip card, registered SmartTrip card holders, and we got just a little shy of 500 responses. What we learned is the people who park at Grosvenor, many are coming down the 270 corridor, and Grosvenor is actually the first metro station that they can get to. So for them to come down 270 and backtrack past Grosvenor and up to White Flint is not really a viable solution for those drivers. So 51% indicated that they would only park at Grosvenor Strathmore and they would not choose a different station. However, for those people who reside east of 270, several 16% are north of the station and 43% are south of the station. Of those respondents, 34% that they said that they could park at White Flint. So that's a pretty significant number that said that they had an alternative. So in short, this is why we would like to bring this to the public for their input, not to move forward with the 200 space expansion today, but to preserve that opportunity in the future as parking demands change. With that, we're recommending authorization to hold the compact public hearing. Of course, we would come back to the board with staff's recommendations and your ultimate decision about what to do.
Thank you, Ms. Albert. Any discussion?
I'm not a member of the committee, but I do have some discussion.
Okay. If no committee member seeks recognition, go ahead.
I'm here to reflect the views of
Montgomery County mostly today. And the county is fully supportive of the joint development project at Grubner and Foursquare in development, as Ms. Albert described. The county, though, is not supportive of the idea to defer indefinitely the 200 parking spots that would be deferred under this action. And the reason for that is when this was approved, I don't remember what the timeline was, about 2-3 years ago at the board level, the expectation is that the 400 spots on the surface lot would be replaced by 400 new spots that would result from an expansion of the existing garage, both in the southbound direction and in the westerly direction. What Ms. Albert is presenting and what the county is telling me is that the southbound expansion of 200 spots will go forward, but that because of construction prices, the added 200, additional 200 on the west side, it would be indefinitely deferred. And the county's problem with that is that the parking facilities are used at very high levels right now. You know, they've provided some, you know, data from, I assume it was Metro data, showing that for the last 12 months, the occupancy rate is 94%, and that, in fact, in the last month, the occupancy rate, and I don't know how you do this, was 101%, and the occupancy rate a year ago in October 2018 was 104%. So this is obviously a facility that people want to park at and want to use, and most of it is for the reasons explained by Ms. Albert. It's the feeder parking lot when you come off of 270, so it picks up all the people that want to come down and use Metro coming down 270 and also coming from the west side of 270. This is the place that they go to. This is the lodestone that they aim for. And so the idea of going forward without those additional 200 spots being replaced is something that the county can't go along with. So I seriously want to urge you, while this public hearing process goes forward, to consult extensively with the county, extensively with the developer, Foursquare, and when you come back to us, come back with a proposal, you know, that has a firm proposal for how these 200 parking spots are going to be replaced. And as part of that process, what the county urges you to do is to conduct a more long-term parking study of parking needs, because while you point out that White Flint may be less used than Grosvenor today, there's a lot of development going on in White Flint in an area to the north, Pike and Rose, and the county has some very strong plans for developing the area right in back of White Flint, and so that we would urge you to come back with a long-term parking study that really shows what are the parking needs for both Grosvenor and White Flint, that broader area, over the next 5 or 10 years, instead of sort of this little parking study that you've presented, which basically hit maybe a quarter of the riders, 500 people, if you assume that everybody parks every day in 1,900 spots, which is probably, you've hit even less than 25% of the normal commuters using that site now with the 500 responses, and come back just like that, because I can tell you that you know, Maryland is not going to be supportive of moving forward with this project unless the parking situation is really addressed. I mean, our principal objective, we're a transit agency. Our objective is to get people riding the rails, and its objective is to make it easy for them to ride the rails. Joint development is great to have a transit-oriented development, you know, but that's kind of secondary to our principal focus, which is to make it attractive for people to be on Metro Rail, and if Grosvenor is where they want to use it, and if Grosvenor is where they want to park, we've got to find a way to make that possible for these people. We don't want the riders to be spending a lot of time commuting up and down Rockville Pike looking for parking spots. We want to be able to get them into their parking spots and get them on Metro as quickly as possible, because as you point out in your survey, you know, the 51% of the people would park only at Grosvenor, Strathmore, and you know, when you cut out those 200 spots, that means that some of those people are not going to be able to park at Grosvenor, Strathmore. You know, so looking at your joint development diagram on slide 4, it would seem that those tall buildings there, I assume have some garages underneath to accommodate parking, and so maybe a conversation of you with the developer and the county will figure out a way to provide for those additional parking spots on a temporary basis when the construction actually turns to the surface lot. So that's all I have to say on that. I think I've explained to you the county's position that I'm relaying, and I encourage you over the next few months while this consultation process is underway to be talking to them, to be talking to the developer, and to be doing a more broader long-term parking study so that we are in a better position to say how those 200 spots are going to be accommodated, either temporarily or long-term, by WMATA, so that this development can go forward. I would ask you to, ask for a piece of information, which I think you've just alluded to, but I'd ask if you could give it to us in a more formal sense. You've said something about the cost of $10, $15 million. I don't know if that cost is referring to the what the cost would be of adding the other 200 spots.
That is what it is.
That is what it is. And if you could just finalize that, if that's the cost, because obviously, you know, the state as well as the other jurisdictions have put in $500 million of dedicated funding annually, and if we can't find a way to provide $10 or $15 million for a project to accommodate riders, you know, especially when the covering costs of that investment are going to be covered partially or largely by parking fees, should be something that we can figure out a way to accommodate so that this project can go forward and the 400 parking spots can be replaced in full. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your time.
Thanks, Mr. Cohen. Any other comments, Mr. Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nina, are there any possibilities of working with the developer to maybe help share the cost of this? Is that potentially something that has been explored or could be explored?
I think there are a couple of different layers. The answer in short right now is that the development and market conditions to develop Grosvenor, even at this level of density, just are not there. So there would need to be a subsidy of some sort to the developer for parking or any other extraordinary or above their own private development construction project. I think that we will have a much more in-depth conversation as a result of not only the public hearing. We have already planned a long-term parking needs assessment, and so I think that we'll share the results of that. I want to explain just two things just for everybody's edification. When parking utilization is over 100%, it's not that there's, you know, people parking up on the berms and stuff like that. It is how many people come in and out all day long. So that's the numerator, and the denominator is the number of spaces that are available. So somebody might come in and then leave during the day, and somebody new comes in, that's a new count. So that's how you get above 100%. At peak hours, which is really what matters, is what is the utilization there? And we estimate, and it depends on the time of year and all those sorts of things, but at the peak of the peak, when it's most busy, we're closer to 90% utilization at the garage at any given time. So it is high utilization. I'm not going to deny that. In part, the history at Grosvenor is that when a turnback existed, everybody came to Grosvenor because they'd have the frequency of Metro service. Now with the turnback eliminated, we have not seen a dramatic shift in utilization up the red line. We have seen growth of ridership up the red line, but I believe that there is an opportunity to see what customer behavior will be and what the change might be once people become more familiar and educated that the turnback has been eliminated and that White Flint is a viable alternative. It's quite congested at this metro station. I agree that the people who park and are coming down 270 will be a difficult population to displace, nor would we want to do that. We want to continue to accommodate them. But there is a large number of people who are parking at Grosvenor today, I believe, out of habit. But I can't confirm that right now, so we'll do more work. And when we come back to you again, we'll have more information, and we will speak in depth with the county and make sure that there's a collective and shared understanding of what the opportunity is and whether now is the time to move forward or what time in the future would be the right trigger.
All right. Brief, please.
Will the revenues from this garage be pledged to the creditors of WMATA, or who's incurring the financing, if any, to build the garage?
Thank you very much.
Sure.
With respect to your first question, I believe that parking fees should be part of the assessments that Nina and her team will be conducting.
Yeah.
To make sure that we're leveraging as much as possible the relevant market drivers as we assess utilization at that particular location. With respect to your second question, no, the developer is providing their own capital with respect to this construction, and so to the extent that, but that impacts the joint development agreement and the revenues that, the future revenues that we might all be getting. So to the extent that, overall cost is contained, clearly both parties will benefit going forward.
One more question. It's a question I'll reiterate. I think I asked it a year ago or 2 years ago. Have we received any advice from USDOT concerning whether or not parking fees are subject to Title VI fair equity requirements promulgated by the Federal Transit Administration?
Yes. I believe we provided a memo to the board on that issue, but the answer is that FTA's position remains that parking fees are subject to the equity analysis that we required, and with respect to both this effort and any long-term outsourcing or leverage lease of those garages, that those constraints will still remain in place.
All right, thank you. And thank you for the memo, which I may have missed.
All right. If there is no further discussion on this topic, can I have a motion to approve the resolution?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you. We move on to the next item. Now, given our time constraint, it's my impression that the all board members, all committee members have had access to the written presentation that's before us. This seems a bit more straightforward than the last item. If there's no questions or discussion from members of the committee, I would suggest we move directly to a vote.
Mr. Chairman, I have one question.
Yes, go ahead.
Nina, if you could kind of talk through what the discussion has been with the county and feel that they'd be supportive of something like this?
Yes. So West Hyattsville is in the city of Hyattsville. The city of Hyattsville, both the city manager and the planning department, has reached out to us several times. They're very anxious and excited for development to be occurring. I'll just throw up a picture while I'm talking. To be occurring around the metro station. There's a private developer that's already begun a plan for 500 to 600 units just at the metro station, which is what this proposal proposes to assemble more land for them to develop even greater density. So the city is very favored, and then also the council member of the district in which West Hyattsville is located, is also, in fact, at a county council hearing that both Mr. Wiedefeld and I attended, she was asking when we're going to be putting out an RFP for development. So I believe that the county is in favor of this. This particular parcel is just a small piece. There's, in fact, no other developer that could develop it because it's landlocked. So from that perspective, it's an unusual joint development. What makes it a joint development is our continuing control of the property and covenants that there be a minimum amount of density on the property as it's developed. Density, so that, you know, it wouldn't be a single family development, but in fact would achieve at minimum 200 units, which is what our goal is.
So we're, you know, obviously very interested in TOD. I would just ask if you could, you know, in the future connect with the EDC just to make sure that, you know, we're all on the same page.
I will do that.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graham. Any other comments? Okay, with that, may I have a motion to approve the resolution?
So moved.
A second? Okay, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you. Now, we'll move to our next presentation regarding a low-income fare pilot in the District of Columbia. Do we have a personnel change there? No. Mr. Leader.
You? Be given the,
yes.
The low-income.
Excellent. Yes. Okay.
Okay.
Floor is yours.
All right. Thank you. The purpose of this action item is to authorize the general manager to negotiate and execute an MOU with the District of Columbia to implement a low-income fare pilot. Already ahead. The program will run up to 9 months and be administered by the D.C. Department of Human Services. Up to 2,500 participants will be randomly assigned to one of the fare products. So there's basically three buckets. The large bucket, which is the control group, it gets no benefit. The second bucket or group will get free transit, and the second one, or the last one, I should say, gets a subsidized transit. The district will reimburse Metro for the revenue losses associated with the free and subsidized trips, so there is no money expected to be coming from Virginia or Maryland for this pilot. There is a separate grant funding that will support the analysis of this pilot program as well. There is a growing interest around the country for transit systems to provide reduced fares for low-income riders. Examples of established programs in North America are Portland, Seattle, and Minneapolis. New York MTA just recently launched one this past January, so the results are still out there. These programs are income qualified and provide either a flat fare or a percent discount on transit fares. Peer agencies have shared important suggestions with Metro. Doing the eligibility certification in-house was found not to be efficient. It is better to partner with an established social service agency, and this is how the pilot is being set up and designed. The transit benefit should also be multimodal, and this provides the best opportunity to increase mobility options throughout the region, and participation will be higher if the program is easy to understand and the use of the fare product is as simple as possible. Now, I would like to turn the mic over to board member and DDOT director Jeff Marudian, who will share some of the background about the lab and DC, and to introduce the lab's director.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Leader. Mayor Bowser has prioritized building pathways to the middle class for residents of all 8 wards of our city, while at the same time expanding reliable and affordable transit options for the residents and visitors who come to our city every day. And the mayor has proposed a pilot specifically to look at low-income fare options. And this builds on the proposal that we had earlier this year to make Circulator a free service for residents of our city. And we have, the mayor has tasked the lab at DC. And for those who don't know, the lab is based in the city administrator's office here in the district. It's an applied science team that works to operationalize pilot programs such as this one. And so the mayor has tasked the lab to bring this program to life in 2020 and to measure its effectiveness and to evaluate ways in which the program could potentially be scaled in the future. So it's my pleasure to introduce and turn it over to Sam Quinney, who's the director of the lab in the city administrator's office, to talk a little bit more about this project and what it would look like going forward.
Thank you, Director Meridian and Mr. Leader, for the background. I want to provide just a brief bit of information on the lab at DC, our involvement in this, and then get into a few more of the details about the project, and then I'm happy to answer any questions that any of the committee members may have. As Director Meridian mentioned, my name is Sam Quinney. I'm the director of the lab at DC. We're an applied scientific team in the office of Mayor Bowser. Broadly, what we're charged with doing is helping our agency partners throughout district government do more of what is working for our residents, and we try to do that by making sure when we're designing new things that we are taking the full weight of scientific evidence and theory into how we design things, but very importantly, we're using the best tools of science to understand if they're having the effects that we want them to have and we all hope them to have for district residents when we're trying to do this important work. So I think this is a really great example of that, and we're very excited to be leading this effort within the district across a broad array of agencies and partnering very closely with WMATA in the design of this and the implementation of it. The origins of this project actually go back over a year ago with discussions between us and several members of WMATA, Mark Urban, Charlie Scott, and Jamie Johnson, where we found a shared interest in really answering this question of what happens when you reduce cost as a barrier to transit for district residents. And then from that point, we start to build out more cooperative partners, both within and without district government. And so within district government, of course, DDOT is a key partner in this, being the point of contact for WMATA. But as Mr. Leader mentioned, one of the key learnings from other areas and jurisdictions is that you need a social service agency to be able to verify income if you're going to be able to serve low-income residents. So we're very excited to partner with the Department of Human Services as the implementing partner of this, through one or more of their social services that they administer, and they will be the enrollment partner for it. I'd also highlight that this is something that that we think the results will have a lot of national interest, both for other jurisdictions and perhaps international interest. We're very excited to have support and grant funding, both from some research funds that DDOT has, but also from J-PAL North America, which is a research organization based out of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Their founders just won the Nobel Prize in Economics, which we're very excited to see about. They're going to be supporting both through grant funds the enrollment design of the project and also some of the research. And we're also happy to be supported by DME in the World Bank, one of their staff members who works on impact evaluations of transportation globally is committed to this project as well. And so that is both an indication of the national interest of it, but also that this is about more than just transit. It is about serving low-income residents and alleviating poverty and seeing what happens when we remove transit as a barrier to all of the other things that we think are associated with a full and productive life in the district. The reason why we think this is a challenge, the reason we think these obstacles exist, for a lot of this we rely on data that WMATA has collected and we're very grateful for in the past. We find from them that that low-income riders often have a higher share of their after-tax income devoted to transportation. We also find that almost 50% of all the bus rides by district residents are made by low-income riders compared to less than 20% of the rides on rail. Now, that may have some things to do with geography, of course, but we think it's also an indication of the relatively higher cost of rail than bus, and we think it's an indication that our low-income residents are making choices about transportation that are not what they would do if cost were not a barrier. And when we think of subsidizing different populations, we also find from WMATA surveys that roughly 65% of high-income riders already receive some sort of a subsidy through their employer, whereas only 10% of low-income riders receive that subsidy. So it's actually our higher-income members of the population that we're subsidizing transit for, and not necessarily for the people that may need it most and for which it may be the biggest burden for that. And as I mentioned before, as Director Meridian said, the mayor is very committed to creating pathways to the middle class. It's not a question about whether we invest in our low-income residents, but whether these are the types of investments that are really going to unlock other opportunities for them. And so very interested to see what happens when we lower the cost of transit in terms of things like access to social services, access to jobs, and other things associated with the quality of life for our low-income residents and their families. We think it's very important, though, that we start this out as a pilot. I probably don't need to tell the Committee on Finance and Capital that at scale something like this is quite expensive. We want to make sure both that we understand how effective it is about the things that we care about in transportation and other aspects of people's lives, but also that the implementation is sound and that we've understood all of the other factors that may come into play. So we think it'll be very important that we understand both of those things. It also has several other benefits to the district generally in that we know of at least eight agencies other than VDOT that provide some sort of transit assistance to clients in their programs, and this offers an opportunity for a new way to potentially centralize some of those services, which we think will create a better experience for our residents in those programs and may also be easier for WMATA to administer. And while our first audience is always going to be what is working for district residents, we understand that this will also inform the conversations for other jurisdictions and how they might engage in similar work over this time. I'll turn it back over to Mr. Leader, but I'm happy to take any questions from the committee if it's useful.
All right. Well, I would like to thank Board Member Ms. Marudian and Sam for your comments. So at this time, we would like to make a recommendation to the committee to approve this item and to allow Metro to enter into an agreement with the district. And we'll open it up for questions.
Okay. Thank you for the presentation. Jeff, unless there's anything we want to add, I'll make an opening comment. Just want to make sure we're precise in language here, not to quibble or in any way suggest lack of support for what you're doing. I think it's a very valuable initiative you've described here today. But the notion that some members of your pilot will be taking rides without a subsidy. The fact of the matter is every ride of every mode on the Metro system has a subsidy. We have as a region, and in the context of this budget, will again determine what is the appropriate level of subsidy based on everybody walking in off the street. Now, as the district has identified in the context of this initiative, there are members of our community who perhaps are in need of a greater subsidy level than the general population. And what we have before us, as I understand the initiative, is something where the entire cost of that additional subsidy beyond the regional consensus is something that the DC government is prepared to bear and would not impact on a net basis the finances of WMATA. I'm getting nodding heads. Great. And as concerns have been expressed by some in our community, about people not being able to afford getting into our system, I'll ask the question I know the answer to. Do we have the ability to determine economic need at the fare gate on the steps of the bus? Are we able to do any type of income verification when a person presents? Of course we're not. Okay. So, as this program is designed, we're able to target, DC is able to target its resources towards those where a need is verified and identified. And so, I'm excited and interested to see how this pilot goes and applaud you for your initiative here. Just one question. Learning how price affects ridership of this population, it wasn't clear to me when I got an earlier briefing on this how the members of the different groups will understand what fares they will be responsible for different types of rides. Buses may be more straightforward, but since rail pricing is mileage dependent, how do they know this is what it's going to cost me and therefore I can make a different decision than I would have otherwise?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your excitement and also for the clarification on the subsidy language. I appreciate that. So I think for obviously when we're talking about people who are receiving just their normal experience on transit, that's obviously they pay what they normally would. And for people who are receiving a free fare, that's probably very easy for them to understand. We are still deciding what exactly this partially subsidized fare looks like and how it is structured. It may be a uniform fare, which of course would be very easy to understand if we were to say it was $1, $1.50, or $2, just one flat fare, whether it's rail or bus, transfers, anything like that. That's obviously going to be very easy to understand, as long as we're describing it well and making sure that they understand it. As we get into percent discounts or other a little bit more complicated options, it's going to be more important that we're able to very clearly describe how people are able to travel and what the costs are going to be, whether it's peak or off-peak or anything like that. So as we decide that, we're going to be taking into account what people are most able to engage with well and understand their transit options. And we've done some initial testing in the Department of Human Services on the different options with potential recipients of this benefit to make sure that as we're describing things, they understand what sort of a fare they would be facing in different situations. So it's a very key concern for us that we'll be thinking about.
Great. Thanks for your answer. Any other comments or questions? If not, Mr. Goldman?
Could I ask this question? Since I understand your presentation that essentially there's no cost to this for WMATA, you're essentially going to buy a block of Smart Trip cards and then decide how many of those are to go to people who pay full fare, part fare, or are fully subsidized. I guess where I'm coming to is, what is the need for an agreement? Why can't you just go out in the street and do this? Why has something been brought before the board that requires an agreement between WMATA and the district government?
Mr. Goldman, the need for that agreement is because depending on the structure that they ultimately decide on, it may not fit neatly into the current structure that we have. If you recall, he's described opportunities across the spectrum, both bus and rail. They have not worked out all the specifics yet, and it is indeed possible that we may have to construct a product that does not currently exist, and to be able to do that, we need this authorization to the general manager to allow us to work constructively with them as they finalize their ideas and finalize the structure of the program.
In other words, it's our systems that will have to interpret the card and assess the appropriate fare, so there needs to be some dialogue.
Provide them information.
If no further discussion, do you have a motion for approval of the resolution?
So moved.
Thank you. All right, we're spreading out here. Second.
Second.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? None. The ayes have it. Thank you. Now, that will conclude the action items for today. We will move on to presentation in anticipation of the public hearing process on the 2021 budget and 21 through 26 capital improvement program. The CFO will have a brief presentation for the committee. You also have before you some of the proposed amendments to the docket that have been shared by a couple of the jurisdictions. And I remind the committee we are not finalizing that docket in today's session. That will be in January. So when we get to that point in the presentation, what I think would move the discussion along most efficiently is if the responsible for some of those proposed amendments could briefly, and I emphasize briefly, explain any nuance that's not obvious from the text that's before the committee right now, and if other members have any strong concerns, questions, support, objections, whatever that they would like to surface at this time, we won't resolve all of those in today's session, but that will help inform the discussions to make January's meeting run more smoothly. So with that, Chair Nasicki, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our goal today is to describe the items that in the proposed FY 2021 budget that would drive the docket that the board will formally consider next month, and ultimately at that time request board authorization to conduct a public hearing on the proposed budget. Tom and I will primarily make jointly make today's presentation, but we have Joe here today. As you know, Joe runs operation and will have both insight and ideas about how to respond to some of the questions that the board may have. Thanks. Okay. As the committee will recall, FTA guidelines requires Metro to conduct a public hearing on a program of projects that are funded by FTA grants. But Metro's compact also requires public hearings on major service adjustments or fare increases as proposed in the general manager's budget recommendation. And as we noted last November, the priorities for fiscal year 2021 remains state of good repairs, more reliable service, and fiscal accountability. With that, I will turn it over to Tom to review the capital elements of the proposed budget.
Thank you, Dennis. As Dennis mentioned, in addition to seeking public comment on our proposed capital improvement program, it's a requirement of our federal Transit Administration grants process to have a public hearing on the program of projects. So we have a work session on the capital program in a few minutes. I'll just quickly highlight, remind the committee that the central focus and strategy of our capital program and proposed capital budget is investments in safety, reliability, and state of good repair projects. The subject of the public hearing is largely the FY21 capital budget, but as a reminder, we have a 10-year capital plan that totals an unconstrained $18 billion, a $9.7 billion six-year program, and a proposed $1.8 billion expenditure budget for the capital budget for FY21. And then this slide shows a summary of investment by category, totaling $1.8 billion in FY21, the largest category of investment being, again, station and passenger facilities in the FY21 expenditure budget. And also summarizes funding sources for the program in FY21 and projected for the six-year period. Federal funding is assumed at formula programs at a similar level to the current fiscal year. PREA at $150 million, again, for Metro's FY21. Jurisdictional contributions increasing by 3%, consistent with the legislation in Maryland and Virginia and our agreement on capital program funding. There's also planned debt issuance that will leverage the dedicated funding. Turn it back over to Dennis.
Thanks again. With respect to the operating budget, in addition to the base services that Metro operates currently, in FY 2021, the major changes are really the additional efforts to both enhance as well as optimize service and to leverage fare options in order to enable WMATA to stay within the 3% mandated subsidy levels. With respect to improving service and customer experience, you'll recall the committee saw some version of this table last time. And again, the focus is primarily designed to not just improve service, but to do so in ways that grow ridership and reduce operating costs. Since last November, or the last time we presented this to the board, the GM has further refined the service proposals. Essentially, two changes were made. One, on the rail side, It now aligns early morning metro rail service to weekday rush hour headways, as well as the ridership, which in a way that meets ridership needs. And with respect to bus service, we've now focused more on reducing bus routes that are tied to redundancy more than strictly performance. If you recall, when we discussed this last month, we based most of the recommendations on productivity. What Joe and his team has done since then is to take a look at the network and figure out, you know, which of those routes have additional services around it that provides at least a minimum level of coverage across the region. And we think that this is a better recommendation to the board. More fundamentally, none of those changes that have been made to the service component of the proposal changes the financial needs of the organization. In the aggregate, this still remains within the budget that the general manager proposed and complies with the 3% mandate. On fares, none of the proposals that the general manager advanced last month has changed. And as I noted last month, almost all of the passes, or rather the passes, the price for the passes are unchanged, except in one case with respect to the 7-day pass, where we are actually reducing the cost of that particular pass. With respect to peak and off-peak, we've also tried to leverage capacity in the system by optimizing fares during those times in ways that do not increase operating cost. Frankly, with some of the proposals that we've made on the bus, it is designed to reduce our cost of collections and therefore, again, help with Metro stay within budget. But if you go down this list, you can see that the proposal is to increase the base Metro Rail fare by 10 cents to simplify mileage charges while increasing the max rail fare by $1. I should point out that as this committee discussed the scenarios last month, there were at least two recommendations that were made, and those are reflected on this particular slide. Reducing the proposed max fares change and increasing the base fare by 15 cents. In addition, there was also some conversation around all air caterings all the time. Those have at this point been added to the docket that the board will be reviewing, but those are not the recommendations of the general manager. In terms of public input, should the committee or when the committee authorizes or debates and authorizes a public hearing, WMATA will conduct its typical public participation process and hold hearings as required by law in all three jurisdictions, following which staff will come back to the board to present its feedback and findings prior to formal board consideration of the budget. This is the timeline that we anticipated to use, subject obviously to board decision on the docket. Mr. Chairman, that concludes our presentation. I'll be glad to respond to any questions.
Thank you. And just a reminder to not just the people at this table, but outside this room, that timeline isn't something where the board can wait to give its input and stamp of approval until June 30th, and then you execute the budget on July 1st. There are substantial tasks that have to be completed, which is why our decision-making process was centered on reaching that vote in March. Now, given some of the complexity of the changes that have been proposed here, we are accommodating requests from some of the jurisdictions for a little more time to analyze before initiating the public hearing process. But I want to make sure that everyone involved understands that this is not a process that can simply drag on until June. This is something where we need to start things, get the management team the policy direction they need from this board so they can move ahead and execute. So, Mr. Smedberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for being a little flexible there.
Okay.
There are a lot of issues, but I think it's important to emphasize again that while this is a slight extension of time, there is a definite pencils down, you know, in early January, so we have time to do all the work. Well, actually, the staff has time to do all the work that they need to do to carry out, you know, to get us to an end point.
Mr. Chairman, if I could,
yeah, of course.
Really important to emphasize the FTA grant application process kicks off following the board adoption of the capital budget. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that that slides from March into later in the calendar, we could be in a situation where we don't have grants awarded to support the capital budget that begins on July 1st. So for the capital program portion, that's critically important. We don't want to slide back to some of the financial difficulties we had in the past.
Yeah, we understand that, but also, you know, the jurisdictions needed just a little extra time to review all the proposals that the general manager has put forward. They are pretty significant. So I wanted to make sure that we had the ability to do some of that analysis. Yep.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the proposed amendments that would have been considered today from the jurisdictions all appear to be relatively straightforward to me. I would invite, however, those responsible for those proposed amendments, if there's something they want to highlight or if any other members have a comment they want to make on those. Otherwise, I think we would take those to offline discussions to determine what will come before this committee in January. So if there is...
I'm clear to describe the Maryland proposal.
Okay. Go ahead.
I guess the Maryland proposals are mostly in the document that has a Roman 1, 2, and Roman 3. And there's really two parts to this. 1 and 2 is designed to rebalance the fare increases between short-haul riders and long-haul riders. Right now, the general manager is only proposing a 10% fare increase, peak fares for base riders, but $1 for maximum fare riders. So 1 and 2 is designed to get Metro the same amount of revenue, but rebalance it so that long-haul riders only have a maximum fare of $6.50, a 50-cent increase, rather than the dollar increase to $7 recommended, and then one would be an adjustment, whatever is needed, to get to the same revenue result from the fare increase. The other items here are, I guess, a response to the general manager's proposal to essentially cut bus routes by calling them redundant or, to paraphrase Trump, low energy or low ridership, and save in cost $34 million and in subsidy $26.6 million. And Tom Graham and I have already heard back from the counties, Montgomery and Prince George's, and there's a number of bus routes on this list denominated as redundant or low ridership, which they don't agree with, and that they think need to stay in the basic Metro Rail system. So if we're going to, and I assume Virginia people, jurisdictions have similar lists of routes that they're going to come up with. So do we have an ability to balance, and to the extent that we're retaining bus routes, we have to have some way to make up for the projected subsidy savings here projected by the general manager. And, of course, that can either be in terms of cuts in other expense categories throughout the Metro Rail budget or as revenue raisers. So what we tried to set out here is a number of potential revenue raisers that could be used to compensate for restoring some of the bus service proposed for cuts, but keep the jurisdictions at the same level of subsidy increase of 3% that's required under the Maryland and Virginia legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. And I'm sure management staff appreciates identifying specific alternatives to make up any revenue loss or spending increase associated with those proposals. Virginia, like to?
Yes.
Mr. Smedberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just highlight the document. I think you've all mm-hmm. have seen it or have been copied on it. But first, add all 8-car trains across all lines. You know, we obviously understand that there are revenue constraints, and this would probably have to be in a phased, you know, implementation. Adding or considering additional weekend options, create a 1 or 2 day or a 1 or 3 day short trip rail pass to target the tourists and weekend markets. Consider marketing and promoting these as weekend passes as opposed to short trip rail passes. And there's some other comments in there. Adding the locals to the pass products, we defer to WMATA to advise on how we can or how this could be effectuated and priced, assuming that a price is not more than $10 for the add-on could work revenue-wise. We would support inclusion of this option. And just a few other comments. You know, we wanted to raise this issue because I think a lot of all the jurisdictions on our side, anyway, I think are pretty much all interested in integrating the local systems into WMATA's pass products, especially the unlimited monthly passes. So we think that this is vitally important, considering proposals of fare increases and free transfers that are before the board this year. So I wanted to put that out there. Local parity with the proposed Metro bus transfer discount increases. And again, you know, this would require a change in policy in the jurisdictions, but may require an advertisement on WMATA's tariff policy as part of the current document. So I wanted to get those out there.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Smedberg. And before we go to you, Mr. Horner, I belatedly need to note for the record that Mr. Graham was recused from the current agenda item. Mr. Horner.
Just a few a lightning round of questions. First, with respect to...
Mr. Horner, please recall that we will debate the merits of all of these.
Right. Just a strictly informational questions. Okay. I won't Terry, does the funding for rail car purchases assume the availability of federal funds as a funding source?
The federal funds can be allocated to the purchase of rail cars, but we've made the internal assumption that this will be funded using non-federal funds.
Got it. And these figures don't reflect any clawback or limitation on the availability of federal funds by virtue of purchasing rolling stock from certain vendors further to newly enacted or about to be enacted federal law?
WMATA expects to be fully compliant with all applicable laws with respect to the purchase of rail cars or other equipment.
Great. And then the last question with respect to the line on rail cars. This doesn't, these figures don't disclose our expectations for pricing on rail power procurements. No?
No, they do not.
Okay. Good. All right. Over to operating. I note that the base amount associated with labor and benefits is nearly twice the base amount associated with passenger revenues. Right. So labor and benefits is $1.3 billion, whereas passenger revenue is 700 million. Okay, that's right. Yeah, that's right, isn't it? Does the item for labor and benefits include a contribution from WMATA to fund pension obligations of WMATA to its employees?
Yes.
Yeah. And according to our actuaries, in the aggregate, in rough number, kind of rough figure, in to what extent are WMATA's pension obligations funded?
80%.
80%. Okay. Thank you.
All right. I'd just like to emphasize to the committee and the board at this time the options that have been presented, which will be discussed and analyzed if there is, from any jurisdiction, an adamant objection to any of these options. We will not resolve that now, but it would be best to know that now so that we can apply our resources correctly. So with a brief pause to see if there's anything like that. No, good. Okay, then. With that, we will close this portion of the meeting and move on to the next agenda item, which is the capital working session. So do we need to play musical chairs at the end of the table? Okay, great. So as a reminder to my colleagues, we've had one overview presentation on this subject matter. There is a capital needs assessment that has been available to board members for about a week now. That's the longer-term document, and there were written questions and answers that were responded to by staff over the past couple of weeks, and there are a couple of thick documents in front of Mr. Webster that we will have the benefit of as well. So as we are going through this session, Mr. Webster will be making a presentation, receiving some questions, some of which he will be able to answer quite readily, some of which will be contained in those documents that he can refer you to, and some of which he'll just have to take back to consult some of the more detailed experts in his operation. So with that, the floor is yours, Mr. Webster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to present an update on the Workers' Capital Program this morning, and recognizing the time and the board's schedule, I'll move very quickly through the presentation. Through our capital program, Metro is improving the safety, service reliability, and financial stability. Over the next 6 years, we will continue to focus on our oldest and obsolete facilities and focus investments in vehicles, stations, infrastructure, and systems to improve safety and reliability. As I mentioned earlier in the prior item, we have a 10-year capital unconstrained plan of $18 billion, a proposed six-year CIP of just under $10 billion, and a proposed expenditure budget for the FY21 capital program of $1.8 billion. Metro's continuing our transition from reactive, urgent projects and maintenance to a more planned, proactive program, looking ahead to the future and scheduling projects for implementation. Again, I summarize this in the previous presentation, detail of the investment by category as well as our funding sources for the next budget year and the six-year period. This summary table summarizes what is in great detail in our forthcoming capital budget publications, and I'd be happy to answer questions conclusion of the presentation. Looking forward, Metro will continue to invest capital funding responsibly and proactively plan to address replacement, rehabilitation, maintenance, and improvement needs. Transformation of our capital program process and strategy is underway, and it's focused on more active capital planning, as I mentioned, improving our capacity to manage and deliver projects, and improved performance tracking and reporting. As the chairman mentioned, we have three publications, one on the capital needs forecast for the next 10 years, capital program strategy and 10-year plan, as well as the proposed 6-year capital program. The total capital needs forecast unconstrained for the 10-year period is approximately $22.5 billion. Plan for the next 10 years unconstrained by funding is approximately $18 billion. The constrained 6-year program is $9.7 billion, and the budget proposal is $1.8. Over the next few slides, I cover some of our highest priority strategic projects and programs. I'll just summarize them briefly. We're moving forward with our 8000 series rail car acquisition. The primary purpose of this is to replace the 2000 and 3000 series rail cars, which were purchased in the 1980s and are reaching end of useful life. Contract, when awarded, will also have options in the out years for potential expansion of the fleet. The cash flow and the budget associated with those would fall outside of the current 6-year period. We're going to continue our track rehabilitation program. We've made great progress through SafeTrack and the preventive maintenance programs. This is an ongoing, annual, required continuing investment to restore and then maintain state of good repair of our track and structures infrastructure. Automatic train control, we will continue state of good repair, safety, and component replacement work this year and into next year, and we're beginning the examination of the future of our signaling system, whether that's a replacement of the system that we have today in its entirety with a new system or another strategy. Platform rehabilitation, the second year of this program will take place next summer with the work at the 4 Orange Line stations in Virginia, and then we'll continue the following summer on the eastern half of the Orange and Blue Lines. Radio infrastructure and wireless program. The wireless implementation is continuing. We have much of the system up for cellular talk, text, and streaming. We have 3 more segments to go that will be completed next summer. Radio program is continuing. This is the replacement of the radio infrastructure as well as the actual radio for our employees and workers. Bus garage rehabilitation, we are kicking off now the replacement of Northern and Bladensburg bus garages within the district. Both facilities, very old, obsolete, replacing them with facilities designed to be platinum that will be electric bus ready and will be constructed for a modern bus fleet as opposed to older facilities that have significant physical constraints. In the 10-year period, we'll also be planning for the replacement of Western Bus Garage, which is the next oldest, and that will follow after Bladensburg. In the current fiscal year, our capital budget is on track. Our actual investment, just over $600 million through the first 4 months of the fiscal year, which is in line with our forecast for the capital budget from the spring. We do have several major contracts, contract awards upcoming that will change the cost estimates and, in some cases, the budgets for projects. We're anticipating, as the budget was put together before we had begun implementation of last summer's platform program, we've incorporated the lessons learned from that and some of the additional work that was accomplished while the stations were closed, and anticipate that the budget and the cash flow for the phase 2 of the platform program will drive an increase in our expenditures in both FY20 and FY21 compared to the prior forecast. We will be returning to the committee in the third quarter, so probably the February or March timeframe, with an amendment as we refine the forecast numbers. That would not involve a request of additional funding from the jurisdictions, result in an adjustment to the planned debt issuance to support the program. And with that, I'll turn it back over to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Webster. Mr. Smedberg, I believe we're going to probably need to ask some indulgence on the end time for this session. We will be as prompt as possible, but yeah. I assume you're okay with us going slightly beyond the scheduled noon transition to the next meeting?
I mean, slightly beyond.
We'll see how slight. We'll see how slight. And I'm eating into it as we speak. So I'll start with committee members and then move to others. Mr. Smedberg?
Yeah, I have two rather quick questions. Tom, in the assumption, one of your overview slides assumes PREA is not authorized. Is there any political risk there for us? Is there going to be any perception risk that, you know, we're doing okay, so they don't need to reauthorize PREA for us?
I'm not. The 1 year as well as the 6 year capital program assumes reauthorization of PREA.
Okay, well, right here in the note it says does not assume reauthorization of PREA.
That's incorrect, and I apologize for that. Which
essentially, we generally show both ways. I think the reality is that PREA has not been reauthorized, and to invest in the capital program at the level we believe we need to, we will have a gap at that point. Here it's displayed as additional debt issued against dedicated funding, which presents obviously some major financial constraints much earlier than we would have otherwise anticipated. We very, very much need PREA to be reauthorized to support the program.
Yes, we definitely need PREA reauthorized. Okay, I just wanted to ask
if I could just briefly comment. Yeah, I think in some past presentations, two or more years ago, some of our federal partners expressed some sensitivity about us assuming action that Congress had not yet taken, and so I think it's very prudent to display things this way while still working for that long-term funding source.
And Tom, is the bus reliability figure low? It's under it's below target bus reliability.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, are we adequately funding for that?
We fully funded our bus maintenance, rehabilitation, and replacement programs.
Okay.
I could just say that in the last 2 months, reliability has improved on the bus side. It's a rolling 12-month average, so that's why it looks lower. But if you look at the last 2 months, we've been up about 7,000 miles, or a little over 7,000 miles. So we're working, the programs diligently to get our fleet back up there where you say.
Just bus lanes are having that much impact already. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll hold on several questions for right now just in the interest of time, but I do want to, first of all, Tom, thanks for the presentation. Very informative. Want to request that the district board members and certainly anybody else that's interested get a briefing on a little bit more detail on the facility issues, Northern and Bladensburg specifically.
Of course.
Okay. Oh, I've come.
Marilyn, Mr. Golden.
Thank you. Mr. Webster, I'm pinch-hitting at the last minute for Secretary Ron, who, as you probably saw the announcement, will be leaving the board, and this would have been his last board meeting, but unfortunately couldn't make that one either. So bear with me as I move through a couple questions with trepidation and incomplete information. On slide 9, dealing with the 8,000 series rail car acquisition, just to continue Mr. Horner's line of questioning. In the second area under the six-year CIP, you identify that as inspection and approval of model rail cars. So does that mean that there would be no delivery of 8,000 rail cars during that six-year period?
No, there would be. The second bullet references the delivery.
So those additional rail cars are being referred to are the 8,000, not any final 7,000 rail car
We anticipate the delivery of the final 7,000 series railcar in the current fiscal year, FY20. The initial pilot car that comes in on the 8,000 series would occur during the six-year period, and then that would be followed during the six-year period by the delivery of additional 8,000 series rail cars for replacement of the 2 and 3,000 series.
Okay. But the numbers here are sort of guesstimates of numbers, since we don't have a final procurement yet for 8,000 rail cars. I mean, how would you identify the level of sophistication or confidence that we as board members should place in these numbers?
So these are not contract costs. These are total project costs for the implementation of the entire 8,000 series railcar program. It is a result of rough order of magnitude estimates of total project cost that drives these numbers when ultimately the contract is awarded and the associated support program management inspection contracts will be refreshing these numbers with the actual budgeted contract amounts.
And what is the number of rail cars that are assumed in this procurement?
It's at the top.
360.
No, it says up to 800, but is it 800 or?
It's 360 at the top.
360.
There's a base order, and then options, and the options could take us all the way up to 800 if we feel we have to exercise those options.
That's what I'm trying to understand. Are the numbers that are presented, the 745 and the 1930, based on just the 360, or are they based on up to 800?
The 10-year plan value is the unconstrained value. It's the total program cost estimate, so all 800 cars.
Okay. And so as the new rail cars come in, then you would begin the third bullet here, is the disposal of the 2K and 3K.
That's correct.
And that's on a one-for-one basis?
That's the plan.
Is that the plan? Okay. Let me just go to the overall slide. I guess it's slide 4, total capital by categories. And just two quick questions here. We had the earlier discussion with Grosvenor with the garage. Where are garages financed under the capital investment categories?
I believe they're under stations and passenger facilities.
Station and passenger facilities?
Garage being adjacent to stations.
And so most of that in the station and passenger facility, I assume now, is the platform rehabilitation project.
Yes.
Okay, but that's the category to come in. And finally, where is the a mobile app project? What's the status of that? And you didn't do a separate sort of timeline schematic for that. Where are we on that? And where does that appear in the capital budget category? And where are we in terms of bringing that online?
In terms of the category, Tom can talk to that, but I was going to give an update during the board of directors meeting on the mobile app.
On both parts or just on a timeline?
The category, Tom can talk about the category.
Okay.
Category again, I'm making an assumption here, but I believe it's in business support for budgeting purposes. I can confirm that.
Okay. And what else is in business support, just in rough categories? And I apologize, I'm sure once you give us that thick blue book, it'll tell us that, but just in broad terms.
In great detail, yes. In business support, we have information technology projects, so support for maintenance, operations, finance. We have administrative facilities that don't logically align with rail or bus or paratransit, so the replacement of this building, for example. And then roofs, things that don't fit in the other categories are sort of summarized here.
Wrong group. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay. I'll have a quick couple of sub-questions on behalf of the federal government side. Thank you for pulling together the debt projections table in response to my earlier question. And I believe from our earlier conversation, those numbers were based on an assumption of no further PREA, that borrowing essentially was the plug where one might otherwise assume PREA.
Yes.
Okay. And you don't need to go through every type of hypothetical, but on the assumption that PREA were reauthorized and this was in fact a stable $150 million a year funding a source, would you see borrowing go down? Would you see an acceleration of the capital program, some combination thereof?
I think we would see borrowing go down over the six-year period compared to...
Relative to that table, yes. Okay. But not necessarily as an opportunity to expand the capital program further than presented here.
Certainly with additional resources, mm-hmm. there are opportunities to accelerate projects from that unconstrained 10-year period.
But that's not the proposal.
That's not the proposal.
Okay, that's not the proposal. That's a policy option that may occur further down the road. Okay. Turning to the rest of the board, Mr. Horner, anything?
No.
Okay. Our newest board member, nothing? Okay. And nothing else from Maryland? Gosh, that was pretty good, huh? Okay, if there is no further business to come before the committee, then I will turn it over to the chairman for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So before I read this, I just want everyone to know that we need everyone upstairs right away. So please don't linger, just immediately go right upstairs. In accordance with the bylaws, I, Paul Smedberg, request that the Board of Directors convene an executive session to discuss the following matters pursuant to Article 2, Paragraph 9, Subsection C, personnel or labor issues, including discussions of labor contracts, labor negotiations, consideration or interviews of candidates for employment, and the assignment, appointment, promotion, performance, demotion, or resignation of individuals, and E, audit matters and investigations to include, for example, audits of IT security matters and investigations to be referred for further criminal investigation or prosecution. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. McMillan. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? You guys have it? Thank you. See you upstairs.